This is Ian Pickus. We're back in the Congressional Corner today with Massachusetts Congressman Richard Neal, a Democrat from the 1st District, in office since 1989. It's our first conversation of the new congressional term. Welcome back, Congressman Neal.
Great to be with you, Ian.
So as we're speaking, you were just with Governor Healey in Holyoke. What are you two working on of late?
Well, certainly the issue of East-West Rail always comes up. And so far, I must say that the progress is satisfactory. We keep moving along. She keeps making pretty good announcements. The partnership that we had by getting the federal money has been, I think, critical. But at the same time, her attitude toward it has been very helpful. And that is that she wants to get it done. She sees it as a priority. And recall, between the relief money that we sent to the state and the money that we sent for infrastructure, the infrastructure side of it alone, I think, was close to $9.5 billion.
Now, this is an issue that I think fits in with all of the uncertainty coming out of Washington, given the fact that federal funding has been frozen in some cases or is being looked at for cuts. So is a East-West Rail project in any sort of jeopardy?
I don't think so, based upon the investment that continues to be made. But understand that one of the things that the president and his administration did, they used the word pause, if you recall. They did not use the word impoundment. And the reason they didn't use the word impoundment was because of the court case that was brought during the Nixon years, in which the Supreme Court clearly indicated that Congress had responsibility for federal spending. And to show you how times change, when the Impoundment Act came to Congress, because Congress took an assertive position, almost every Republican and Democrat in the House of Representatives and in the Senate decided that they were going to tell the president, keep your hands off of our constitutional responsibility as the first branch of government. So I'm hoping that Republicans will embrace a better attitude about their responsibility. This is not a new argument. It dates back to Runny Maid in 1215 with King John and Magna Carta.
Oh, it's going way back.
Well, it's going way back, but it's a reminder of why it's important to question the authority of a president or the edicts of a king. And that is that the House of Representatives doesn't serve under the President of the United States. We serve with the President of the United States. And the only difference that would take place if they allow this continued erosion of congressional authority is the President would get to decide how to spend the money and not the people that are closest to Congress, and that is members of the House of Representatives.
So what is your sense of where House Speaker Mike Johnson is on that question? On the one hand, he is a very close Trump ally, quite clearly, and has, in his comments about this very issue, seemed to suggest that Congress, you know, would abdicate that right. But on the other hand, you know, he's been in the House for a while. I imagine he's something of an institutionalist.
Well, I would remind the Speaker of the House, as I have, when we had the dust up in late December after we had reached an accord, and he reneged because of a tweet from Elon Musk. And I challenged him on the House floor at that time. And I would remind him, as I just noted a moment ago, that he doesn't work for the President of the United States. He is part of the congressional branch of the government, and it is not his job to do what the president says. It's his job to consider what the President of the United States has to say.
We started talking about Governor Healey, and I always like to take your temperature on Massachusetts politics. She's obviously now confirmed she's running for re-election in 2026, and there are some Republicans making noise about running. Do you feel like she's in good shape to be re-elected?
I do. I think she's done a really good job. She has a very regular presence here in central and western Massachusetts. And I must say that when you get a hold of her, she calls right back. She's very interested. She certainly is up to speed on many of the major issues that confront central and western Massachusetts. She's been a good and reliable partner. And the other part of it, I think, is that she has broad appeal to that 495 Beltway area, which is not hemmed in by Democrat-Republican politics. They are individuals who have arrived here by the tens of thousands to go to work at places like Dell in the high-tech industry, to work in the industries that surround investment in computer science. Also, Kendall Square in Cambridge has the highest concentration of R&D in the world. All of those industries mean that the people that have arrived, they lean more in an independent direction. And I think, as was the case with Governor Baker, she has very broad appeal amongst them.
Now, in the last election, Donald Trump did make gains in Massachusetts, as he did in other blue states. So what signs will you be looking at in the 2026 race to make sure that, you know, Democrats are bouncing back the way I imagine you'd like to see them do?
Well, I think it's certain that we're going to frame this argument pretty precisely, and that is you have a billionaire class that's in the White House, in the cabinet, and they've been the sponsors of this president, and they're the ones that are pushing to cut Medicaid for people who really need it. They're the ones that are pushing to hem in Medicare and even threaten Social Security as they ply through the records of Americans every single day. It's outrageous that you'd have some 24-year-old kid going through records of Social Security and Medicare. Remember, in Social Security, there is a category of disability. There's a category of survivor benefits. There's old age pensions. But in Medicare, there's also four parts to it. In Part D of Medicare, the prescription drug benefit, that means this 24-year-old kid is probing what your prescriptions might be without any constitutional confirmation. I think that we all should be alarmed about it. We continue to raise our voices, but we are going to draw the lines over these cuts that they're making. And consider that they're proposing to raise the debt ceiling by $4.2 trillion to justify a tax cut. Can you imagine what Republican reactions would have been if Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, or Joe Biden said we're going to raise the debt ceiling by $4.5 trillion? They would have been beside themselves in opposition. So we intend to challenge them on these proposals to cut Medicaid, and we certainly are going to defend Medicare and Social Security going forward.
You obviously are the ranker on Ways and Means and the former chair, which we've talked about over the years. The analysis of those tax cuts that I've read concludes that they will overwhelmingly favor the wealthiest Americans. Is that your read also?
Oh, it's clear. And I think what you want the listener to pay attention to is not what they say. You want the listener to pay attention to distribution tables. And that means the breakdown or the allocation of who received what tax cut. And they were using an example the other day on the House floor during the debate, which I took exception to when I spoke. They were suggesting that a family of four would benefit by having up to $1,700 a year of tax relief. Well, that's terrific. But what we really want to do is to focus on what a billionaire is going to receive in terms of tax cuts. So we can't let them get away with the camouflage of suggesting that this is a tax cut for the middle class. If you made under $33,000 this year, and the tax cut went into effect next year, you're going to receive $158 of tax relief. That's a fact. And I dare say that Elon Musk is going to receive a much more generous tax cut than the people at the bottom.
Do you understand how Musk became so influential in this administration? I mean, I know we're used to seeing him on the news now, but he's not in an elected position. He hasn't been confirmed. And yet he's, you know, standing there with his child in the Oval Office.
Well, I also thought that the picture of him with the chainsaw was outrageous. He has no portfolio, no official standing. He has not been confirmed by the Senate of the United States. And incidentally, remember, he was in the White House at one time telling everybody what a great job Barack Obama was doing.
Have you been surprised at how President Trump is proceeding? And from your perspective, is it better or worse than what you expected?
It's a continuation of the chaos that we witnessed from 2016 until 2020. There's no doubt about that. Every day you wake up when there's a new assertion, there's a new effort, I think, to mislead the public. I mean, you are in a room and you're meeting about tariffs, and you walk out and the press says, what about the Panama Canal? The next day, if you're in the room and you're talking about something in tax policy, you come out and the press says, well, what do you think of seizing Greenland? What do you think about changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico? And I think that the disturbing part about it is that we're being asked to react not to policy considerations for things that are unlikely to ever happen, but it's an effort that they've made to flood the zone, as it's called, and that is to keep people off guard because of the things that they're trying to say and do. And let me say this emphatically. Every president since Harry Truman has been steadfast in their opposition to Russia's expansionist policies. The argument that Putin has now is how to develop and build a greater Russia. He has seized Crimea, he has threatened Georgia, and he has seized landmass in Ukraine. And I'm struck by the fact that a president of the United States would have instructed the diplomatic corps at the United Nations to vote with Putin over Zelensky and our European allies. NATO has worked extraordinarily well, and I think that we should be adhering to it. And let me also say that I was in Washington, and I remember the celebration that we had with the collapse of the Soviet Union officially, the end of the Berlin Wall, the yoke of Marxism being removed from the necks of the people of Eastern Europe, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, all embracing liberty. These folks in Eastern Europe and across the Baltic nations and the Balkan nations, they do not want to go back to Soviet domination. And we should not be insulting and pushing away our NATO allies. NATO has worked remarkably well.
You know, that resolution you mentioned, we joined nations like North Korea and Russia in the way the U.S. voted, which is really astounding. Another thing, just as we're speaking, the White House meeting between Zelensky and Trump and Pence ended with basically Trump threatening Zelensky and Zelensky leaving, and the press conference hasn't happened. I don't know if you've seen the video as we're talking, but it was pretty shocking to watch, to be honest.
I'm informed about it with the video, what happened at the White House, and I can't believe that a president of the United States would side with Russia against Ukraine at this particular time. We should be cheering for Ukraine here to stand up to Russia. And I think that at the same time, wherever Ronald Reagan is today, he must be looking at Trump and saying, whatever happened to the bipartisan foreign policy that steered down the Soviet Union after World War II?
So what do you think it is? Because you're closer to it than we are, obviously, and you have more information. This has been going on for a decade now, wondering the affinity between Trump and Putin, Trump and Russia. But now that he's back in power, it takes on another dimension. I mean, do you have an explanation for it?
My explanation is that he's become an apologist for Russian expansionism. And I don't understand what this is about. And I think most Republicans quietly don't understand what it's about, although there were some Republicans this week that did, without criticizing Trump, they took a critique of what he had suggested and proposed, and they were pretty tough in their language about Russian expansionism. Anybody that thinks that the next step is not going to be a more aggressive tone from Putin, they're making a mistake. We didn't ask for the military to be committed to Ukraine. We simply asked that we meet the same level of support that we were asking of our NATO allies. I think that's a reasonable consideration.
So let me for a moment go back to domestic policy. As we were talking about, the House approved the budget framework the other day by the slimmest of margins. Were you surprised at all to see the borderline Republican votes or folks who had been expressing some concern about the package ultimately get in line with it?
Well, I was there at the time, and I got to tell you, they were going wobbly. They didn't know quite what to do. And I think they were convinced with some pressure from Trump to switch their votes. And I know that some of the calls that they took in the Republican cloakroom were right from him as he implored them to vote for what he wanted them to vote for. Then they began to take the position, well, this is really only about the framework of what might happen. Let me tell you, the alignment between their proposed tax cut and their proposed expenditure is clear. So they're saying that they're going to cut many of these very important domestic programs for the purpose of justifying a massive tax cut for people who, number one, don't need it, and people at the top who haven't actually asked for one. So they're barreling down this path. I think it's a huge mistake, and I can't emphasize enough the idea that you would have a billionaire class, in some instances, receiving a tax cut at the expense of people at the lower end of the economic scale. And indeed, in the middle class, as it relates to Medicare and initiatives like that, they would bear the burden of these proposed tax cuts.
Now, Democrats obviously don't have a lot of cards to play. Is there a plan from your party to stop the eventual budget bill from matching what was passed as the framework?
We sure do, and we're going to stay with it. We're going to continue to point out who's going to get what in terms of the tax cut. We're going to continue to point out that this is unjustified under any circumstance. And I reminded all this week at a markup of the Ways and Means Committee about the following. And the following was pretty simple. They borrowed, emphasis on borrowed, a fact, not an opinion, in 2017, they borrowed $2.3 trillion for the tax cut. And can you imagine borrowing $2.3 trillion so you could cut taxes for wealthy people, which did not, by the way, jumpstart the economy, as they've suggested? And also, it's a reminder, the new proposal from Republicans in the Senate is, well, we're just going to forget about the old baseline. So my suggestion is, if they're going to forget about the old baseline, we ought to tell the American people, yeah, don't worry about your credit cards, because that's exactly what they're saying. The debt is the debt, and a lot of it comes from the tax cuts that we've had from Reagan to Bush Jr. to Trump. It's almost $10 trillion.
Do you see that the Senate approach to this and the House approach, which have been different to this point, will be able to be rectified in a way that puts it all into what Trump wants to do, which is one big bill?
There's a clear schism between the House Republicans and the Senate Republicans. And my hunch is that based on the language that has come from the Senate Republican leader in the last 48 hours, they are not going to blindly accept what the House did. But people need to keep an eye on this as it goes forward, because once they set the ceiling on spending, that's when we'll have an understanding of the depth of the cuts that they're proposing and the depth of the tax cuts that they're proposing for wealthy people.
Do you see the possibility of a government shutdown coming in the next few days?
I do, unfortunately so. And I think that Trump has the ability to remind Republicans that they hold the presidency, they hold the House of Representatives, and they hold the United States Senate. And if it's their wish, they are able to avert a government shutdown. I think in the past that Bill Clinton won the government shutdown with them. I think in the past that Barack Obama won the government shutdown with them. And I would remind all that we went through a long, long government shutdown in Trump 1's presidency. My hunch is they have or should have learned the lesson.
Let's talk about Social Security specifically. I heard Trump saying the other day that if the 200-year-olds who are on the rolls stop drawing from Social Security, they'll be able to balance the books. But in all seriousness, what's the plan with Social Security, given that there is conversation about threats to it?
Well, I won't vote to cut 10 cents from Social Security. We are now on the 90th birthday celebration of Social Security. We are on the 60th anniversary of Mr. Johnson signing the Medicare Act in 1965. These initiatives have worked far better than even were anticipated at the time. There are now about 68 million people who receive a Medicare benefit. 71 people derive a Medicaid benefit. And I believe about 67 million people receive Social Security. The efficiency of Social Security is there for all to witness. It's very simple. Fewer people administer Social Security than any private retirement plan. But you need both, the private retirement plan and the supplemental insurance that comes with Social Security. Social Security is also an earned benefit. You paid into it over the course of a working lifetime, and then you derive the benefit at a date certain. So with Social Security, my hunch is, despite what they say, and by the way, that was a complete fabrication. When Musk and Trump were talking about 150-year-olds receiving Social Security benefits, that was nonsense. There was no evidence of anybody over 100, for that matter, drawing an outrageous benefit or anything that they hadn't already earned benefit. They were doing that in a hyperbolic manner for the purpose of ginning up the American people to make it sound as though Social Security was loaded with fraud. I think that that is reckless and irresponsible, and Social Security has worked splendidly. The argument is very simple. In our youth, we all pull the wagon because in old age, we might have to sit in the wagon. So Social Security is a critical part of American life. And I believe that the average Social Security benefit is about $24,000 a year. That means half the people who receive Social Security are receiving less than $24,000 a year. It is a critical part of our retirement picture. And Trump and Musk and these others, they ought to leave it alone.
I don't usually take a position on this show, but I will say if somebody is 200 years old, they should be able to take whatever they want from Social Security. They've earned it.
I'll be at that birthday party.
Yes, for sure. So I was wondering, you know, your district obviously has a share of federal employees and defense employees. Given the conversation about cuts and the federal freeze, do you know what the impact has been on the First District so far?
Yes, we're starting to hear from people now who are being laid off at the Springfield Armory Museum. That story that was terrible this week about the individual who had done tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, come back, taken a job about 9 months ago at the Veterans Center to help with counseling, and laid off. People are going to start to feel this because of layoffs at the FAA. We're in the midst now of the high point of tax filing season, and you're not going to be able to get people readily on the phone to answer questions. And I also think that Social Security Administration individuals have been notified of some layoffs as well. So I don't understand this other than how cruel it is. I mean, there's ample opportunity within the framework of federal employ. If Trump wanted to make a point, he could put a freeze on federal hiring, for example. But not to do it this way, where people go home and they find out through an email that for no apparent reason that they've lost their jobs, and next week maybe forcing a move on their mortgage payments. I think this is unnecessarily cruel, and for them to use some of the examples they use, it's reckless and distasteful.
Won't it, the thing I can't understand, because I get sort of the politics of it, but if we have 2 million federal employees and a huge chunk of them are fired for very little reason or no reason, I was listening to our station the other day, and there were workers coming out of USAID who had, you know, put in 30 years in the federal government and were suddenly without a job. Won't that have the opposite effect on the economy that the president ran on saying he would address?
No question. Coupled with the fact that when you consider that at USAID, you had now Republicans who have run it who have said these cuts are reckless. You've had five former IRS commissioners, including the Republican Rettig, who ran the IRS for 5 years. He is the one that asked for the money to expand the IRS. It didn't come from Dan Werfel or Joe Biden. It came from Commissioner Rettig at a time. So when you look at these proposed cuts and the way that they're being implemented, as I've said before, there's a callousness to it. And I don't understand for the life of me why you would think that you would say to somebody who had given their professional lives to 30 years of service at USAID, or for that matter in the American military, only to be told that without hearing or airing, you're losing your job.
So I've been asking members of Congress as they come on the show during the early part of this new term about the Laken Riley Act. That was, I think, H.R. 2, and 48 Democrats voted for it. You voted no. Why did you decide to vote that way?
Because even though my sentiments were in favor of addressing the issue, I don't think that you could ask somebody to be deported based upon suspicion. That was the sole basis of the opposition vote. If they wanted to fine-tune the language and come back with somebody who had been convicted of this or that, and after they've been challenged successfully through due process, they should be removed from the country. There's nobody that's defending that. The simple argument here was the compelling nature of what constitutes suspicion. So every single day you could have an opponent or an enemy that said that you should be charged with the following crime based upon suspicion. That's a long way from saying that you should be deported based upon suspicion. So that was the only grievance that I had as it related to the nature of the legislation.
We're sort of running out of time now, but I wanted to ask you this. Hakeem Jeffries, as I said earlier, obviously doesn't have many cards to play. How do you feel he is doing as minority leader so far?
I'm very pleased. I think that the leader, I think he's got a good grip on the caucus. I have breakfast with him. There's about 12 of us every Wednesday morning. And we go through what we think is a pretty sound strategy. We consider alternatives. And I think that he's got a good presence. He's good on his feet. And I also will say he's a really nice guy, but he is determined to push back on what he believes to be the aggressive and unnecessary positions that the president has adopted.
Have you seen anything from the White House or the administration, either public statements or executive orders or proposals that you have agreed with so far?
Well, I mean, I think, look, if there was some relief on credit card interest rates, we'd all be in favor of that. I mean, that's not exactly a challenging one. But as far as that goes, I don't understand much of else what's coming from the administration at this particular time. And I hope that this thing will smooth itself out in the next few months as people really begin to feel these cuts. But I will tell you, I don't think that's going to happen. I think people are going to be furious as they continue to witness the damage that's being done to the American economy through these proposals.
Well, we're always very grateful for all of your time, Congressman Richard Neal, a Democrat from the 1st District, and we will be checking in a few months. We'll see what the mood is at that time, and thanks, as always, for spending these congressional corners with us.
Pleased to be with you, Ian. All the best.